Holding my chest.
My legs and hands.
Silence.
Feeling the pressure.
What?
She was a fraud.
It's a million bloody degrees out there.
No wind.
I'm sorry if I said anything awful.
Blessed lambs of God.
Why hadn't he got up to chop the capsicums?
I was never a good reader.
Immaculately bland.
Anyway, it looks like...
What do we do with this now?
You're not even supposed to use the word fat.
Boys like girls.
When we were very young...
I was back home in Norwich.
Square Sound. You're listening to the audiobook podcast for the makers and listeners of audiobooks.
Hello and welcome again to the audiobook podcast, recorded here in the Square Sound booth in Melbourne, Australia. I'm Justine Sloan-Lees and I'm here with Abby Holmes.
Hello.
Now, Abby and I have both been working in the industry for quite some time and we're hoping that our combined skills will help you develop your own skills in audiobook narration.
I first met Justine when she was producing at the ABC in Melbourne in the 1980s, when the ABC was doing all manner of things, fabulous radio plays, short stories.
Children's.
Poetica, children's story. Oh, it was an incredible time. So thankfully, audio recording has come back into our world via the growth of people listening to audiobooks, which is a fantastic thing. So today we're going to be talking about the casting process, which is something that you're most involved in. So let's take it away, Justine, just talking about how you begin the casting process and how people approach you, perhaps.
Well, as a production house, we work to a range of publishers. So we will get a brief from the publisher and they will have an idea of what they want, often, sometimes not. So I have seen a brief that said, male, 40s, comforting.
Oh, wow.
And had to try and come up with a suitable person for that. We also did recently see a brief that said, rocking a Hemsworth vibe, which we thought was quite amusing. So in that case, when we get a brief like that, we will normally from our voice bank, and later on we'll be talking about auditioning to become a member of a voice bank like mm-hmm. ours, and we will put up a range of voices, say between 3 and 5 maximum. You don't want to overload people with choice. Sometimes they won't consider any of those voices appropriate, but their comments will help us then refine in another direction. Often, if they like a voice, they might want that person to do a bit of submission from the text. So we would send a section of the text to the performer and ask them to read it just on their smartphone and send it in as an MP3 just to aid that decision-making process.
Mm.
Sometimes a publisher will have an idea who they want, and that might be when it's a book by an author who has had previous audiobooks recorded by the same person. So sometimes actors become the voice of a certain... author, which is great for the actor.
Fabulous.
Sometimes they might want high-profile talent. That's not out of the question, a high-profile talent to try and sell a certain title. There's also the question of author-narrators. Now, this is one that divides people.
Yes, it does a little.
And I think from my point of view, as someone who has spent a lot of time recording author-narrators, that there's some very clear distinctions I want to make. Fiction, non-fiction. I can't see of a reason why an author would read a work of fiction. I think that works of fiction are nearly always best served by an actor.
Well, I would definitely agree with that.
Then we come to nonfiction, and then I'm going to break it down a bit more. So nonfiction, memoir. I think there is often an argument for having the author read memoir. I think any deficiencies in the performance compared to what you would get from a professional narrator are overlooked by the listener because it's the veracity of hearing the voice of experience.
Yeah, it's forgiven that they don't sound like an absolute pro.
That's right. And I've heard of people who will only listen to memoir read by the author.
Right, yeah. Well, I can understand that. And also in any kind of non-fiction title where the person speaking is the expert.
That's right. That's what the other category I was going to delineate was pieces of commentary, journalism, polemic, where it's very much invested in the person's personal point of view and ideas. And often these people are people with a public profile anyway. So examples I can give that I've recorded, 2 Australian women who are writers/journalists/public commentators, Jamila Rizvi and Clementine Ford. These are both women with a public profile, a large social media following. So to hear them read their own works is much more powerful, and I don't think the audience would want to hear someone else read it. For an overseas example, someone like the late Christopher Hitchens,
mm-hmm.
I don't think you would have wanted to hear anyone other than Christopher Hitchens read Christopher Hitchens.
Yeah, yeah.
When it comes to more general nonfiction, say like history or biography, I don't think it matters as much.
Yeah, sure. Well, my feeling is that I certainly agree with you on the point that a nonfiction book needs to be read by a professional because it's more complex. It has many, many, many deeper levels. It's not just one voice. The other thing is that I think a lot of publishers get feedback from people at book launches. Oh, it was so wonderful to hear her read from her book. They go, an audio book there. But when you're actually watching someone and they're 100% in the room and they are the author and they are reading their words, it is a little exciting. But the fact is what audiobooks are and what narration is only disembodied voice. And that disembodied voice needs to carry all of the visuals and all of the messages and all of the story. And that's where the skill of an audiobook narrator can't be underestimated, where an author will just simply fall down having to take care of that consistency. And I actually think there is a problem with many, many people, even though everyone can read, okay? It's a given. We can all read. But when it comes to storytelling, that's a whole other story. Pardon the pun.
Yes, I agree with you. Yes. And I have to say that sometimes the decision is outside your control. Sometimes publishers will make decisions that the author doesn't get any say in. The publisher, generally speaking, has the final decision. In the instance when a publisher comes to us and says, we want the author to read this, we audition them. You have to be auditioned. And we will make a recommendation to the publisher based on that. We will provide the audio and we'll give our recommendation. There is a reluctance in some areas of the audiobook industry to have authors read, and I think that partly that is to do with production costs because time is money, and often authors, being generally speaking inexperienced in performing in the booth, can take longer to get the hang of the recording process. But conversely, they know the text back to front. They're the ones who composed it, so sometimes they're quicker.
Ah, that's interesting.
It all depends.
I mean, have you ever met an author who jumped into a book and you thought, actually, this person is a damn fine book narrator?
We have had that happen.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
And do the authors get paid in the same way that anybody else would for reading their own book?
Authors do get paid for reading their own book. Mm. But if we go back to talking about narrators who aren't authors and casting them, we get the casting brief. We are interested in finding the right voices, obviously, because if we cast the wrong voice, it's expensive all round and also quite distressing for the person who's been incorrectly cast. So when we audition people, we try to find out what their strengths are. We ask them, what do you love doing? And we have readers who say, I really don't like nonfiction, or I really don't like fiction. I like the nonfiction. We ask people about any accent strengths they might have because I would think it's fair to say you'd normally be cast reading in your own accent. That's why audiobooks are produced in different places, relevant to the context of the book. Sometimes accent skills are required. We had a book recently that was a young Australian girl who ends up in Texas, so she had to be comfortable, the performer, with doing a Texan accent. So part of the thing for us in casting is considering all those things, people's attributes and strengths and whether or not they might be appropriate. Mm. And we encourage people to say, I'm not comfortable with this if they're not comfortable with it. We really do. Yeah. We don't want people to feel compromised and do a job that they're not happy with because it's something that's not appropriate to their voice or their style or their skills.
There's a fabulous website for dialects and accents.
There is.
What's that called?
It's dialectsarchive.org.
I do get a lot of people sending me demos which have accent work included on them. And for the commercial world, which I, you know, coach for a lot, it's not as required. Just as you said, you know, mostly wherever you live, you're required to do a voiceover in your accent. But I hear an awful lot of people doing accents that they think are pretty good that are just completely inauthentic. And all of a sudden their Australian accent will pop through. And you can't have that. I mean, if you are a book narrator if you're a really good sight reader, don't put up your hand and say, I can do a great Scottish accent if you can't. It's possible that in the book, you can use some of your accents with some of the character work. It's possible, it can be useful. But unless you are absolutely authentic and perfect at it, don't do it. And we're actually going to have a podcast soon with Lise McPherson, who is a
brilliant dialect coach.
Wonderful dialect coach, and she'll be giving you some fabulous tips on that.
Authenticity in accents is quite important, and we have to consider the context into which the end product is going. So, for example, we were asked to do content for India, so Indian-accented English. We had to be very careful because actors doing what they thought was an authentic Indian accent really didn't ring true to the head office in India. And so we ended up submitting local people that we found who were from India but weren't actually narrators. But with guidance from us, they could develop their performance skills, but more importantly, they had the authentic accent skills. Yeah. And also what we found was a number of the books had Hindi words, and so they knew the Hindi. And so it made, in the end, it was a bit more work, but it made for a much more satisfying listening experience for the Indian market.
Yeah.
So here's a sample of Smita Singh narrating for an Indian title. In this, you can get a sense of what can be accomplished with the right guidance and preparation.
In the year 2008, a fresh graduate from IIT Kharagpur and a fresh chartered accountant decided to shake up an age-old industry. Today, MagicCrete is a ₹150 crore company which is changing the face of construction across the country. IIT Kharagpur is the IIT in the middle of nowhere. Kharagpur is a sleepy little town with the world's longest railway platform, but it has no mall, no multiplex, not even a half-decent restaurant. When I first visited IIT KGP in the year 2008, I thought to myself, how quaint! The best way to spend a long night on the campus is hanging out with friends, sitting in someone's room, chattering about everything under the sun, having a bath session. In one such hostel room, D206, RK Hall of Residence, Saurabh Bansal was cooking some khichdi, not with dal and rice, but with some very crazy ideas. The topic was, what do you want to do in life? Koi kuch keh raha tha, koi kuch aur. When suddenly, the aforementioned young man stood up and wrote a number on the wall. 5,000 crore. I said, I want to start a business and I will take it to 5,000 crore. At that time, Saurabh was a third year student. He did not have a business card that read, founder of XYZ campus startup. But he knew ki kuch apna karna hai.
Fabulous. Just talking about the actual audition process. So somebody makes contact with you and says, I'd like to audition.
Yeah.
And you then send them material
based on material.
The voice that you hear, their disembodied voice.
Based on age, gender, obviously, is obvious place to begin. But we send a few different things in different styles. So a piece of non-fiction prose, a piece of fiction prose. And we also ask people to bring in something of their own choosing. I do this with my students as well. The first time I put my students in front of a microphone, I ask them to select the material because I ask them to bring in something that they love and that they feel that they can connect with and communicate out. That is a really good idea. If you want to impress someone, read something that you really like, that you want to tell the story. So people come into the studio, put down an audition, and then, presuming we're happy with them, they go into the voice bank. Now, unfortunately, they can sit in the voice bank for quite some time before an appropriate book comes up. And interestingly, books seem to come in ebbs and flows. So all of a sudden, you'll get a whole bunch of books that are early 20s female. And so you're scrabbling around trying to find every early 20 female you got. And then no one asks for an early 20 female for the next 12 months. So I realise it can be disheartening as a performer, and this is part of the performing life. You know
That's
all too
true.
Well, Abby,
yeah.
That even though you may have passed the audition, there may not be a suitable book. But trust us that your voice is in our voice bank, and that is one of the skills of voice casting, is just our familiarity with all those voices. And interestingly, my colleague Marianne and I often come up with the same name for the same book because we've been doing it together for some time. And we'll both come up with this same name. It's like, oh, snap.
And, of course, as far as working with somebody is concerned and having them on your top-of-mind list, I suppose it's about how well they work in the studio, what their relationship is like with you. It's really about the collaborative process because it is a collaborative process.
It is. But I always stress to my students that you have to be easy to work with. You can have the most beautiful voice, going back to the beautiful voice. If you're difficult to work with, no one wants to work with you.
No one wants to work with you. Yeah, be a nice guy, even if you have to pretend.
So people's professionalism, the way they conduct themselves, does actually influence decision-making too. If you have a choice between two people and one of them, you know, always comes in prepared, they come in on time, they're easy to work with, you're going to choose that person over the person who comes in running late, they haven't finished reading the book, not quite sure what happens.
Quite a few drinks the night before and they're a bit croaky or they're not hydrated properly.
Yeah.
Because their consistency is going to be affected.
Or they'll question the decisions, you know, oh no, I think that was fine. Why do I have to do it again?
Oh no.
Yes.
Anyway, we're going to wrap up today. Thank you so much for listening and being a part of it. And we look forward to talking to you again next time.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the audiobook podcast brought to you by Square Sound. If there's something that we haven't covered in our audiobook series that you'd like to know about, send us a message at studio.squaresound.com.au. The audiobook podcast was produced by Marianne Plaza, together with Abby Holmes and Justine Sloan-Lees. With special thanks to all our guest speakers, Square Sound is an audiobook and podcast studio in Melbourne, Australia. Thanks for listening.